When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to a pole position. Yes, we are back. No, we don't have 20th century history. I have listened to Alex. I have taken my punishment and gone and found you something completely different. So today I've got with me David Gralik. He's a PhD student at Adam Mickiewicz University in Poznań, which is in northwest Poland, which I've been told to say just in case. He's a military historian specializing in the Napoleonic period. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Napoleonic period. I have gone down the dark side, but don't worry, because I have someone with me who's going to hold my hand along the way, because yet I have not had a co-host on pole position, but this time I am going to have a co-host, and that is the wonderful, the only Sam Jolly. Hi, Sam.
Hello, darlings. Thank you for having me on. I'm very excited about today because whilst I love the Napoleonic period, I'm ashamed to say I know very little about Polish history in the Napoleonic period.
Welcome, David. Hello. How are you doing amongst these two lovely ladies?
Hello. I'm very well, but I feel a little bit outnumbered. Thanks for having me in your podcast.
Hold on. I'm the one in the middle because I have a Napoleonic historian to my left and a Napoleonic historian to my right. I think I should be the one that should be outnumbered.
Okay, point for you.
I'm in a Polish sandwich. Does that make me some salami or something?
I think in our own way, we're all outnumbered on this. But I'm excited because we're doing some Napoleonic history and we've got a deal here, ladies and gentlemen. So when Sam feels that she doesn't understand a context, she is allowed to wave her white flag, which she will be waving. I, on the other hand, don't have a white flag. I only have a copy of Hitler's Furies by Wendy Lauer, and I'll be waving that if I don't understand in the Napoleonic. So hopefully we will make some sort of sense while we're doing a Napoleonic Polish pole position. God, that's a mouth. Yeah, anyway, let's get some questions going because you want to hear David, not me. So let's kick off, like, the easiest and the most simple question is, like, where did your interest in the subject of the Polish officer corps, because that's what we're going to be covering today, during the Napoleonic Wars come from, and what do we actually know about it?
Well, to be honest, when it came to choosing a topic of my doctoral project, my first thought was precisely the officer corps of the Duchy of Warsaw Army, and what's such a topic? I could say that I was inspired by one of the professors in my department who said during my very first year of studies in the class about ancient warfare that the matters in analyzing military history is not only the description of wars, great battles, maneuvers, or biographies of famous commanders, but also the soldiers who fought these wars, officers included. Across the board, the Napoleonic era is not different in this apart. Especially since it was a period in which many outstanding commanders lived, of course, Napoleon himself, but also Prince Wellington, Archduke Karl von Habsburg, etc. Of course, behind the choice of the subject was also the fact that it's purely research. Quite quickly, I found why such a situation takes place. Well, the number of archival sources for this topic is quite limited, because of the losses that Polish archives suffering during World War II. And during it, for example, the central archive of historical records in Warsaw was destroyed. and with it almost all regimental books and therefore the primary sources on which normally I would work. By the way, as I look at my colleagues in the West, some included, I'm often simply jealous that they have such a wide source base, which allowed them to trace the fate of even private soldiers of the Napoleonic Wars. Sometimes I wonder if they know how lucky they are that they can work with such a number of different sources. There are a few areas for me that are impossible to do research, at least when it comes to the Duchy of Warsaw Army.
David, I'm going to cut you off very briefly, just to give our listeners a bit of context. Why do we not have these documents? Why do they don't exist? What happened to make all of this just be non-existent?
These documents existed before World War II, and they was in Warsaw, in archives in Warsaw. And during the Warsaw Uprising in 1945, there were tough fights in the city of Warsaw. They were also bombarded by Germans, and they destroyed this main archive where these documents were. So we don't have most of these documents nowadays. For example, we've got a series of documents named Dombrowski's Files. It was documents collected by General Jan Henryk Dombrowski, one of the main Polish generals of that period. It was a large collection of the documents which Dombrowski collected through his quite long life. And they were given to this archive in Warsaw, and it was if I remember well, destroyed in about 80%. So it's a huge number of documents we couldn't know, we can't know them because of the Germans, World War II, etc.
I feel for you, obviously, for a lot of my master's thesis, as you quite rightly say, the British archives survive. But my thesis wanted to touch upon some Prussian things. And there is nothing as soul destroying when it comes to archive destruction when you find that the records you want were destroyed by your own air force.
I know this problem. I have one of my colleagues from Katyusha is researching Prussian things, and he says that because of the Potsdam bombings, he's got his own problems too. Anyway, returning to the main threat, the state of knowledge at the moment is such that the Polish generals on the Napoleonic Wars period have lived to see their own general study. And we also have biographies of more important generals, although not all of them. A few of them, like biographies of General Stanislaw Fischer and Prince Antoni Paweł-Sukowski, I will talk about them later a little bit more, have been published relatively recently in the last few years. In my opinion, in general, the social aspects of the functioning of historical armies is a developing branch of research, also in research about the Napoleonic Wars period, because it's part of the so-called new military history. So obviously new brand of research, right? Returning to Polish officers, there is room for improvement, a set of knowledge, which I intend to take advantage.
So the officer corps in the army of the Duchy of Warsaw, what does this actually mean? Who do you include in this group?
Well, the answer is not obvious, primarily because of the confusion that existed in the first month of the Polish army of this period, which was actually established before the Duchy of Warsaw was created, which is quite interesting. But we will have the opportunity to say more about it in the moment. And this initial period, one can speak of a strange situation in which there were many officers who had an unregulated status. Second issue was ending point, because in theory, the Duchy of Warsaw army existed to June 1815, when the Congress of Vienna decided that the Duchy of Warsaw won't exist anymore. And its army were transformed into Army of the Kingdom of Poland, so-called Congress Kingdom. So in the end, I decided to research only period when Polish officers were elements of the Napoleonic system, because it creates one coherent and logical narration. because of things I mentioned before, I had to define certain criteria according to which I move. And I decided that I would adopt two main criteria. First, that I would only deal with officers serving in the line units of the Dutch of Warsaw Army between 1806 and 1814, and thus excluding military administration, except for the general staff, health services and irregular formations like levée en masse, which existed in years 1806 to 7 and in 1813. And secondly, that the officers had to have served at least one campaign as part of the Polish army, as we have situations, especially in 1806-7, when officers, for example, served in the staffs of French corps, later entered the Polish army for a while, and then returned to the French army. For example, the Chevalier or of the Imperial Guard, which had been formed since April 1807. That was, in fact, the case with Chevalier commander Count Krasiński. With this framework in place, I'm preparing a list of officers as well as conducting quantitative and qualitative analysis.
For our listeners, please explain what the Duchy of Warsaw was, just to be on the safe side, because I can see Sam's eyes going, Duchy of Warsaw, talk to us.
Well, Duchy of Warsaw was a state created after a peace of Tilsit in 1807. It was created by some of the Prussian lands, which in the previous years was part of the Polish 20 Commonwealth, because our listeners have to know that, of course, in the previous centuries, there was a huge state, Polish 20 Commonwealth. And in the 18th century, the state was quite weak, and it was destroyed by their three neighbors, Prussia, Austria, and Russia. So the Poland didn't exist in the beginning of the Napoleonical period. And when Napoleon entered Polish lands during his war against the Prussia and Russia in 1806, he decided to do some movements in the Polish cause, because he knew some Poles from his previous years. For example, he knew General Dąbrowski, because these Polish legions were created in Italy when Napoleon was a commander of the Army of Italy during his first Italian campaign. So he knew that something like Polish people existed, and there's something like Poland, or this spirit was something because of the partitions, of course. So this was a state created, like I said, by Napoleon from part of the lands of the Prussian partition, and from Polish people, it was some kind of hope to reestablish Poland, and that's it. I think you understand what I mean.
I love that beacon of hope, because it doesn't end up going very well for the next 100 years.
Yeah, but there's one of the books about the Duchy of Warsaw, and its title is A Small Country of Great Hopes. And I think it's a good definition of what the Duchy of Warsaw was.
Oh my God, that made my heart flutter and cry a little bit on the inside. So anyway, back to your research. I just wanted our listeners just to have a bit of a background knowledge of what we're talking about. So let's go back to the beginnings of this officer corps. Talk to us. Tell us how to develop in the following years.
So as I mentioned some time ago, the officer corps of the Duchy of Warsaw Army began to form before the Duchy of Warsaw was established, in fact. After the French victories in the battles of Wien and Auerstedt in October 1806, it was clear that the Grand Armée would enter Polish lands, and it would be a possibility to reopen the Polish case, because the Prussians were retreating to the East Prussia, awaiting the arrival of Russians. In that situation, Napoleon, as I said, summoned General Dąbrowski, who was in Italy at that time, because they knew each other. And just Napoleon wanted to know more about Poland, the situation. He wanted to know what he can expect when his army will be in Poland. Also, Napoleon ordered Dąbrowski to create Polish army because it would be, of course, a better situation for French themselves to have an ally who knows the territory, this whole theater of war and stuff like that. So creation of the army started, and officer corps also. Dąbrowski, together with his friend Józef Wybicki, who had also arrived in Berlin, issued a famous proclamation that included a famous phrase, Napoleon told us, I will see if the Poles are worthy to be a nation. With the 19th century context, it means that I will see if you are worthy to have your own state, right?
That hurts. That hurts me really bad listening to that.
You know, it was pure politics, you know. It's something for something, right? You will help me, I will help you, and there is nothing for free, you know, in the international politics, in the Napoleonic Wars or World War II or every single historical period. So this wasn't an exception during the Napoleonic Wars. So anyway, Dąbrowski went to Poznań, the first major city on the Polish soil. When he entered in early November 1806, when he was received with enthusiasm of the people, he immediately began forming troops with the help of officers who were in the area and who he often knew, whatever from the Kosciuszko uprising in 1794 or from his service in the legions. And after the French entered Warsaw a few weeks later, the situation changed as Prince Józef Poniatowski, nephew of the last King of Poland, was appointed as a new chief organizer of the army. As this was a way of trying to convince the Polish aristocracy, which in the absence of clear declarations from Napoleon regarding the Polish cause kept its distance from the French. That's why Poniatowski was appointed Minister of War in newly formed Polish government. Eventually, as a result of the Treaty of Tilsit, as I said, the Duchy of Warsaw was established. After the signing of peace, the ordering of troops began, which was necessary in view of the existence of units that hadn't been provided for in the new structure. Which in the end included 12 infantry regiments, 6 cavalry regiments, and 3 artillery battalions. And this, moreover, had led to the phenomenon of excess officers, or in other words, there were more officers in the army than the army needed. This continued until the war against Austria in 1809, when new regiments began to be formed. When in the end that the army had 18 infantry regiments, 16 cavalry regiments, a regiment of foot artillery, and a regiment of horse artillery. In addition, of course, to the functioning of the general staff and corps of engineers, something for Sam, but more in the British edition. Sam approves, so you don't see it. As of November 1st, 1810, there were 2,030 officers in the Dutch army. After the start of the war against Russia, regiments began to be formed in Lithuania, so part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. So there was a relation right between Polish lands and Lithuania. However, they were not subordinate to Poniatowski. Only after the defeat in Russia, they were in fact incorporated into the Polish army. In the German and French campaigns were already see a smaller number of officers, which was due to the reduction of the army related to losses during the Russian campaign and next campaigns.
David, I'd really like to know a bit more about the officers who served in the army of the Duchy of Warsaw.
Okay, so due to the lack of sources, it's difficult to analyze the officer corps in terms of social background. However, it's likely that most of them came from the nobility. In fact, this would be a continuation of the situation before the partition of Poland, which occurred at the end of the 18th century, so a few years before. Despite the opening of the possibility of promotions to officer for people from other social classes, even before the partition, it's likely that the number of such officers was not large. If any, they were bourgeois. Therefore, the main criteria of division for me became the military experience that officers had at the time of receiving their first officer rank. Taking this into account, it's possible to distinguish four main groups, which I will allow myself to briefly introduce to you and to our listeners. And I will start with the group that can be called the core of the officer corps. At the very beginning of its existence, that is the former officers of the Polish legions in Italy, which Dąbrowski commanded. These legions were created in 1797 in Italy, and it was created by a group of Polish immigrants in that period, which wanted to fight for the Polish independence, of course, and these legions existed a few years, but the results were quite small, and most of these soldiers and officers just died because they were sent to San Domingo. And it's a tough thing. This group was quite experienced officers who had considerable combat experience and combatants, of course. Also working in their favor was their knowledge of the French army and all the modern solutions that appeared in it during the revolution and the first years of Napoleonic France, like modern military administration or tactics. The problem was the small size of this group. Some of these people were in Poland as they had resigned after the Treaty of Lunéville in 1801 and returned to their homeland. However, a large part, as I said, just died. For example, during aforementioned San Domingo expedition, right? Or were still in Italy, as there was an infantry regiment and cavalry regiment, which were, so to speak, heirs to Dąbrowski's legions. Napoleon initially decided not to pull them to Poland, these two regiments, instead ordering that only some officers be sent to Poland. It's likely that such a policy was due firstly to the fact that he wanted to keep these regiments under his control, as they were developed into the Vistula Legion in the following months. But he may also have feared an influx of more officers, as firstly they were devoted to Dąbrowski, as can be demonstrated, for example, by letters they sent to him from Italy in late 1806. And secondly, a large numbers of them held Republican views, and having in mind the not so nice treatment of Polish troops in the 1800s, he may not have wanted to decisive role in the Polish army to be played by officers who could potentially be skeptical of him and negatively influence the attitude of the Polish aristocracy, so Poniatowski's group, towards him. Nevertheless, it can be said that ex-legions officers played a significant role in the Duchy of Warsaw army, even in its final period. For example, in 1814, among senior officers, more than 30% of them were former legionaries. The second group of officers were veterans of the army of the pre-partition Poland, that is people who served in the military before 1795, when the third and the last partition took place. In their case, two important points must be noted. First, they were often officers who had a long break in military service. It is worth noting at this point that the organization of the army of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, as well as the art of war used, was different from that of the French army. I mean, this revolutionary and Napoleonic army, which created a few problems, especially in the first months. The second point is that, contrary to appearances, this group shouldn't be seen as exclusively old veterans, since some representatives of this group entered military service in the 1780s or even 1790s. In fact, they usually had a history of participation in the war against Russia in 1792 and in the Kosciuszko uprising in 1795. Nevertheless, their length of service was sometimes not so long. In the case of senior officers, there was the issue of physical fitness and therefore ability to serve in the field. I'm aware of several letters in which Dombrowski is asked to be relieved of given duties due to poor health. The third group consisted of people who hadn't served in the military before the Napoleonic Wars. There were two main reasons why they have an important part of the officer corps. First, because, as I said some time ago, of the shortage in the number of the experienced officers available. In this situation, local organizers assumed that it was worthwhile to appoint local youth from good homes, especially of the local nobility, as junior officers who could be taught the art of war, especially since they often showed greater enthusiasm than veterans. Secondly, financial issues were an important element. And here it's worthwhile for our listeners and to you, Alina and Sam, to know one thing. If you say Polish army, you think financial problems. The problem of financing the army was present in Poland, in fact, since the medieval ages. And the Napoleonic era was no exception. Therefore, it was decided to turn to the local aristocracy on the principle, you give us money to form an army and we will give you military rank. At first, it looked like a given aristocrats financed one regiment for which the aristocrat got the function of chief of regiment. In fact, something purely formal. Nevertheless, quite quickly, this function was abolished, and these people either got the rank of colonel and thus began to be formal commander, or they left the army entirely. So there was a group of officers with high ranks with no experience. Some efforts was made to minimize this risk, for example, by assigning them as majors, that is, as deputies, experienced officers from whom they could learn. Anyway, it turned out that several capable commanders emerged from this group who even received general ranks, as in the case of Prince Sukowski or Count Stanisław Mierzyński. This last group, which is, I think, the less known, are the officers which served in the partitionist armies, because in the many noble families, there was a tradition that members of these families are serving in the military, right? And of course, it was a break in existing of the Polish state, so they decided to serve in the partitionist armies, right? It was treated like it's just a source of income, it's just a work, and we are not Prussian or Russian patriots in most of the examples, but they just were there, right? We can even found some more or less Polish regiments in these armies. For example, in the Prussian army existed one of the last regiments, which by the way, mostly deserted when they fought against the French. And in the Austrian army, there was also a few Lancers regiments, and in Russia also. Going back to the more general view, the above division shouldn't be treated rigidly, as it happened that one officer belonged to several of these groups. For example, he started his career in pre-partition Poland. He fought in the legions later, and next point of his career was the Dutch Opossum Army. Sometimes these were quite interesting biographies. As an example, we can cite Berek Yoselewicz, who was one of the few Jews serving in the Dutch Opossum Army. He was a merchant by profession. And during the Kosciuszko uprising in 1794, he came up with a project to form a radic of the cavalry regiment composed of Jews. And after agreeing to it, he was appointed colonel. His regiment, however, failed to take part in the fights. 2 years later, an analogous project was presented to the Austrians. However, they rejected it. And in view of this, Yoselewicz left for Italy and served in Dombrowski's legions, where he reached the rank of captain. In 1802, he transferred to the French army, and as a commander of an elite company of one of the Dragoons regiments, he took part in the Battle of Austerlitz, for which he received the Legion of Honor. In 1707, he transferred to the Dutch Apostle Army, commanding one of the squadrons of the 5th Regiment of Mounted Riflemen. And he died during a skirmish against the Austrians near Kotsk in 1809. Another interesting figure was Józef Sowiński, who began his career during the Kosciuszko uprising, then joined the Prussian army, and he took part in the war against France. For the Battle of Eylau, he was awarded the Pour le Mérite, so the highest Prussian military decoration. Although he was taken prisoner during this war, he didn't decide to join the Polish army, and that's an interesting thing for me. He did so only in 1811, so a few years later. He took part in the Russian campaign. During the Battle of Borodino, he lost his leg. During the retreat, he was taken into Russian captivity, from where he was released after almost a year, thanks to the help of his former commander from the Prussian army, Prince Augustus of Prussia. And returning once again to more general considerations, the question for now still open remains the proportions between the above mentioned groups. I haven't yet worked out the final results, so let me give you these proportions as far as colonels are concerned. While this will not be a final statistic, it, in my opinion, provides some starting point. At the start of the Russian campaign, out of 35 regiments, they were 10 colonels ex-legionaries, 14 pre-partition officers, seven rookies, so who started during the Napoleonic Wars, and 4 from the partitionist armies. And now let's lean into how this division affected the functioning of the army in practice. As I said, in the early days, when they were not established bylaws yet, diverse experience could cause problems at the level of soldier training, because, you know, I have my methods, you've got your methods, stuff like that. And applied combat tactics. It was different for officers with legion experience and different for those who had no such experience and had served in the Commonwealth Army or in the armies of the partitioners. Of course, over time, the standards tried to standardize, at least when it came to infantry and artillery. Another observation of mine is that there was probably also a shortage of experienced officers in general, especially when it came to junior officers, so those who had the most frequent contact with privates and on whose shoulders rested the day-to-day aesthetic of regiments. We are familiar, for example, with requests sent to Poniatowski as a minister of war not to transfer a particular officer to another regiment, as he was one of the few or even the only competent officer to conduct training in whole company, battalion, or even regiment. These deficiencies in training also sometimes made themselves known during field operations. For example, there is a known example of a squadron leader, so quite high rank, who during the Russian campaign of 1812 unnecessarily alerted the entire corps because he mistook the Russian troops for Allied troops from Westphalia, if I remember it well, so German troops. Similarly, poor organization of marches was one of the reasons of the high losses suffered by Poles in the early stages of the Russian campaign. The same is true, for example, of military administration, because in the Dutch of Warsaw Army, French standards were introduced for conducting administration, which included, for example, keeping records of correspondence or accounts which were subject to inspection. For a large part of the officers, if not the majority of or all officers, this was a complete novelty with which not all of them were able to cope. You know, for example, I just know a few letters that there is written, please give me another place of service. I don't want to be a person, for example, I don't want to be a bureaucrat. I want to have a command in the field and stuff like this. And in the sources, we can find examples of harsh assessments levied against, for example, the so-called dress captains responsible for the state of uniforms and equipment. They were allegations of financial errors or bad record keeping. In general, from the sources known to me, officers didn't show a penchant for this type of activity. And in the field of skills and competence, it's also worth noting that they were also problems on the ground of foreign languages skills. At the beginning of the 19th century, French was the most widely spoken language. And one could say that its status was more or less what English is today. Nevertheless, back to the main threat, knowledge of French among officers wasn't at all super common. Even if we assume that a large proportion of officers came from the nobility, who in theory should have had some education. This created problems, obviously, when there was a need to cooperate with other armies, especially French, because Duchy of Warsaw Army was, of course, an element of the Napoleonic military system. For example, Major Cyprian Zdzietowiecki from the 4th Infantry Regiment fighting in Spain reported in 1809, I quote, "It's a misfortune that only three officers in the entire regiment and that mediocrely know the French language. For the smallest thing, I need to speak and write alone." So this guy have a lot of work to do, trust me. And sometimes even the knowledge of the language didn't allow to avoid mistakes, bigger or smaller, sometimes with bad consequences. For example, we know of a case when a Polish officer sent with a report to the French commander, misstated the number of opponents. He said 500 instead of 5,000. In French, it's 500 instead of 5,000, which contributed to a bad recognition of the situation by this French commander. Of course, efforts were made to raise the level of officers through both top-down and bottom-up activities. As for activities at the state level, it is worth mentioning of existing of military schools for the education of future officers, with both volunteers wishing to join the army and non-commissioned officers enrolled in the relevant courses. Particularly noteworthy is the artillery and engineer application school, several graduates of which after the Napoleonic Wars became generals. Among them were, for example, Józef Bem, leader of the Hungarian uprising in 1848, Ignacy Prądzyński, one of the commander-in-chiefs of the Polish army during the Polish National War of 1839, and Klemens Kłaczkowski. Many of these officers were valuable acquisitions for the army. So the level of education was quite high. As I mentioned, activities were also carried out from the bottom up, which consisted, for example, of one of the experienced officers within the regiment conducting courses for his younger colleagues, which was particularly useful when people without military experience became officers. Here, however, it is worth mentioning that the attitude of such people to the possibility of acquiring knowledge sometimes was varied. For example, Prince Sukowski wrote in his letters to his wife that he spent a lot of time learning the art of war, which, given that he was a very ambitious person, didn't have to be far from reality. In contrast, sometimes something quite the opposite was recorded in the memoirs by Major Lazare Coquignon, a Frenchman serving temporarily with the Poles. He wrote that commander of his regiment, Prince Radziwiłł, came to Września, the city in Great Poland, when he was stationed, and he observed his classes. Coquignon wrote, I quote, I persuaded him, to Radziwiłł, to study and offered him training to his room. However, his attachment to his guitar and pipe overweighed the study of drill and maneuver regulations, so he learned nothing.
David, you've like blown my mind with so much information. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how I'm going to cope with all this overload of information right now. I don't know how you're doing, Sam. Sam's waving. She can't even hit the unmute button.
So overloaded, I couldn't even operate my computer.
Do you know what we're going to have to do?
I'm sorry.
Do you know what we're going to have to do? Because we've got so many more questions. We're going to have to come back with a part two. So we usually record on 40 minutes, ladies and gents. So what we're going to do, we're going to cut David off right here. And we're going to come back with a part two. I don't know what you think, Sam.
I think that's an excellent idea.
Perfect. So, David, we're going to say thank you so much to you for now, because we are going to come back with a part two. So beware, wait for another couple of weeks and we'll post it up for you guys. Sam, thank you so much for co-hosting with me. David, thank you for doing part one with us, because we're now going to enter part two. So follow, like, and do all the usual Twitter things, and we'll see you on the other side. Oh, and Merry Christmas, everyone, because we're coming up to Christmas.
Thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to you all.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books. You can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.